From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the 1990s, David Brock wielded a mighty pen for the far right. He famously called Anita Hill a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty, and later wrote a scathing, supposed expose of Bill Clinton's Arkansas liaisons in Troopergate. But that was then, and this is now. Now he wants to take it back. He's privately apologized to Anita Hill, publicly apologized to Bill Clinton, and in his new memoir, Blinded by the Right, David Brock admits that the writing he did then was part of a hardcore right-wing conspiracy to take back the U.S. presidency. Funded by hell-for-leather Republicans, he attacked, smeared, and scandal-mongered his way into the angry heart of arch-conservative America. At the time, he happily served the right, but has since changed his political spots from conservative to liberal, and is now biting the hand that once fed him. We're talking tonight with David Brock about dirty politics on a grand scale, conservative spin doctors, and his own political about-face. What do you remember about the political scandals of the 90s? Did you believe what you read, what David Brock wrote? Did it compromise your faith in American government? And what questions do you have for the mudslinger who was there on the inside? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be joined in just a moment by David Brock. But first, I want to turn to our On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Say hello and good evening first, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
And Jack, you've read David Brock's new memoir, Blinded by the Right. It would be, maybe it would help kick us all off if you gave us a little reading, maybe just the first couple of graphs from the prologue.
Sure. This is a terrible book. It is about lies told and reputations ruined. It is about what the conservative movement did and what I did as we plotted in the shadows, disregarded the law, and abused power to win even greater power. My story is about those familiar corrupting influences of ambition, greed, and ego. It is about how human weakness, lack of confidence, and emotional discomposure can lead to a susceptibility to manipulation for bad ends. It is also about the dangers of zeal and extremism in a political cause and about how one can be blinded to the ethics of one's own actions.
That's Jack Beattie reading from the prologue of David Brock's Blinded by the Right. We are joined from Washington by David Brock. The new memoir is Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Good evening and welcome, David Brock.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
David Brock, you've always managed to write in a way that fully got our attention, and now you're writing that what you got our attention with was fully larded with lies. Wow. Tell us, I don't know where to begin here. What turned you around from the very hard right path you were on?
Well, obviously, it wasn't a process that happened overnight. It's been going on for about 6 years. I guess I would date, if I had to one point. I would say that the earlier work I did, the Anita Hill book and the Trooper story, I believed what I was writing when I wrote it, but there came a point in 1994 when I was reviewing a book on the subject of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill that had some damaging information about Thomas in it. I found out that that information was true, and I wrote the opposite. I covered that up. I concealed the truth at that point. And I think that's really when I hit rock bottom and I saw that all the other distortions and the checkbook journalism and the bias had led me actually to lie in print. And I think that my mindset began to change at that point. And I worked out in the telling of the Hillary Clinton book, which was my second book. I worked out a lot of my views about Clinton hating because I spent a lot of time in Arkansas and I began to see what that was all about. Had significant second thoughts about my own work, and then that led to significant second thoughts about the character of the people around me. And it wasn't really finally until the last 3 or 4 years that the fanatical ideology underneath it all was what I started to question.
David Brock, your book lays out in astonishing detail the volume of falsehood that was at the heart of so much of the debate, the Sturm und Drang and Führer of the 1990s. Take us, if you would, on a tour of your most damaging lies, exaggerations, and their consequences.
Highlights. Well, I think that I think you could start with Anita Hill, and that's where I date a lot of the vitriol that characterized the politics of the 90s. That book was originally commissioned as an article for the American Spectator that was paid for by a woman who was on the board of an organization that was strongly defending Clarence Thomas. When the hearings were over, I didn't make things up. What I did was I went to Capitol Hill and got all the things the Republicans didn't use in the hearing against Anita Hill, and those were not corroborated things. They were not necessarily verified, and I put them into print. That became a book, basically I was using the same kind of journalistic technique, so it looked like journalism, but it really was part of a political operation. And, of course,
the consequences in that case?
The consequence of that, I think, well, one, I think you had a legitimizing of Clarence Thomas. Certainly, you know, I had no role in his confirmation, but I think a legitimizing of his reputation after he got on the court was probably the main consequence of that. Then I think that another consequence of that probably was for the right wing. It set kind of a rhetorical low mark, but it was something that was imitated quite a bit on the right wing.
So, give us another high point or low point in your lies, exaggerations, and consequences hall of infamy, David Rock.
Well, I guess the second thing to go chronologically would be Troopergate, which was an article for the American Spectator that introduced Paul Jones to the world. And there were problems as well with that article. Along the same lines, person behind that was a financier of Newt Gingrich's GOPAC. Back in 1993, 5 years before anybody heard the words Monica Lewinsky, was openly talking about how to get Clinton impeached. And so that's really the root of a conspiracy that later comes to focus on the Paul Jones case and leads to the president's impeachment. Now, the problems with that article are that Peter Smith, the GOPAC financier, later paid the troopers to talk to me, unbeknownst to me, the troopers' own credibility was called into question later when they were put under oath in the Paul Jones case, and two of the four original troopers took back everything they told me.
But in a way, you were then helping lay the groundwork for an impeachment effort.
Absolutely. No one knew precisely how things would work out, but that was the motive at the beginning. It was to disable and destroy the Clinton presidency, which was regarded on the right as illegitimate. The effort came to center on the secret legal team that was advising Paul Jones behind the scenes. So by 1997, 6 months before the Monica Lewinsky story broke, one of her lead lawyers told me that he did not believe Paul Jones and explained to me exactly how they were going to set a perjury trap for Bill Clinton.
That trap was?
Well, what he said was that he didn't believe Paul Jones. The case was not about sexual harassment. It was about a fishing expedition that the Jones lawyers had conducted into Clinton's private life, consensual life, and get him into a position where he's under oath and basically try to trap him into lying about his private life. And that was the plan. That's really a textbook definition of a conspiracy. It was a wrongful scheme, and it was an abuse of the legal process.
We're going to come back to this notion of conspiracy. We heard Hillary Clinton use the phrase vast conspiracy, and we all laughed, or a lot of people did. You've got another view of that. But tell us first, did facts matter during this period at all to you and your sponsors?
Yes, I think they mattered somewhat. In the early period, it was really an arrangement of the facts in a way that would lead to a certain ideological conclusion. So what didn't matter was the other side of the story. It was very much a black and white world, good versus evil. There was an inherent bias that, it was almost unrecognizable in your own mind. It was such a trigger kind of reflex.
So when you say it was about the arrangement of facts,
right,
is that just spin, and is that a misdemeanor, or did it add up to a lie?
Well, I think it added up to a lie because it added up to a false portrait. In the Anita Hill case, to character assassination, and later, of course, I learned that there were things in that first book that were wrong, So I don't know that that makes the first book a lie, but it certainly makes it wrong. And I found out contrary information, for example, on Clarence Thomas's history of renting the kind of movies that Anita Hill talked about in the hearing. And, of course, I was sold a bill of goods by the pro-Thomas camp that he was as pure as driven snow and nothing like this was possible. And yet, 2 years later, through a friend of mine who was a best friend of Clarence Thomas, I posed the question about this, and the answer came back that he had done this.
David Brock, we heard Jack Beatty's reading of the opening of your prologue, but put it in your fresh words for us. What the devil were you doing?
What the devil was I doing? I think it started out as a combination of ideology and emotion. I don't think this was unusual to me. I think the whole generational cohort that I grew up with had its right-wing politics based in a lot of anger and hatred. And so it was more that than it was a deep philosophical commitment. There was an ideological zeal, but I don't think it was all that well anchored in any kind of scholarship or philosophy. Later, it became a lucrative marketing device. By the time Bill Clinton came into office, I think you can see that the conservative attack machine really thrived and found a market niche as well. And so for many of us, I think that was an aspect of it, too. There was opportunism involved.
Jack Beatty, what a story. It makes the entire kind of right-wing framing of Bill Clinton in the 90s look just as rotten as it could be.
Yeah, David Brock says this is a terrible book. It's an appalling, maddening book. I wanted to throw it and the author against the wall many times, but he beat me to the punch. It's full of mea culpas and areas of guilt and repentance, and the whole thing has a kind of morbid air to it, I must say. It reminds me of a kind of low-rent version of the essays in The God That Failed, a 1950 volume by ex-communists like Richard Wright, Arthur Kessler, and others about, the wool falling from their eyes and seeing what communism was. You know, everything for the party. Lie for it. Blind yourself to realities like the mediocrity of Clarence Thomas for it. Advance its aims surreptitiously, disguised a smear as investigative journalism, and count on the legitimate press to spread your lies. It's all here. And it's a very, very depressing and maddening book. And as I say, the author doesn't escape whipping by himself, but the reader wants to pile on.
What do you want to ask David Brock, Jack?
Oh, I just want him to tell us to diagnose the pathology of this right-wing culture. We haven't had anything like this in this country since communists. With their disregard of the truth, their means justify the ends, their ends justify the means, morality. How do you understand this mindset?
David Brock.
Well, I guess, one of the searing experiences I write about in the book was the Bork nomination and how that left the conservatives in a situation where they were willing and able to justify to themselves any kind of smear in return for what they regarded as smears against Bork. And so in some way, that began as payback.
Turnabout's fair play.
Mm-hmm. That payback, and that payback legitimized saying anything to hurt the other side. And so I think it started there. I think that the rise of Newt Gingrich to power is a key element of this, and that the Gingrich style of politics was something that was adopted widely in the right wing, and that was to use scandal as a path to power, whether that be personal or political scandal. But it certainly wasn't a substantive agenda for the country. It was to tear people down and destroy people's reputations.
We're going to come back and talk about those dark rivers. David Brock, author of the new memoir, Blinded by the Right, the Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Listeners, are you shocked to hear these stories about the 1990s engines of anger? Do you see Hillary Clinton's vast right-wing conspiracy in David Brock's stories? And do David Brock's tales make the 90s make more sense to you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with David Brock. He was best-selling author of The Real Anita Hill, of The Seduction of Hillary Clinton. He called Anita Hill a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty, and it stuck. And now he's author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. He wants to tell about the conspiracy behind what he wrote in the 1990s. In a way, he wants to take it back or try and explain it. Are you shocked to hear these stories about the 1990s engines of anger? Is this the hidden history of the 90s? Is the American mind, the American media, hopelessly open to manipulation then? What about now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Brock, you bring it down to a pretty sharp point here. You say that the right wing was willing to employ extra-constitutional means to achieve, essentially, a coup d'etat in the country. How seriously do you mean that?
Well, I could take you to a dinner that was held in the fall of 1997, and this is, you know, 4 or 5 months before anyone knew of the existence of Monica Lewinsky, and this dinner was held on Capitol Hill, sponsored by the magazine. I was still working for the American Spectator, and it had the leadership of the conservative movement in terms of writers, political operatives in attendance, as well as Congressman Robert Bob Barr from Georgia. Mm-hmm. And the subject of this evening's dinner was how to gin up support politically in Congress and in the public for removing Clinton from office. And again, there was a statement there by a Wall Street Journal editorial writer named John Fund that this had nothing to do with evidence or a constitutional threshold, but this was simply a matter of political will of the right wing. And so to me, that is a coup. In the fall, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, ran column headlined Impeached. There was a book published, The Impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton. And this is all, before Monica Lewinsky. Judge Robert Bork endorsed the idea of impeaching Bill Clinton before Monica Lewinsky was known. And so I do think that it really was that it betrayed a frame of mind that was willing to trample the Constitution for their partisan ends.
You write that John Fund said at that dinner that impeachment was not a matter of law but of political will, and you write, listening to these influential Republican conservatives contemplate trampling the Constitution for partisan ends to gain power they couldn't win in an election almost physically repulsed me. Talk to us about that structure of the attack machinery. You write about an inner circle and an outer circle. At the very core, who and what and how was this onslaught being funded and orchestrated? What was the very heart of it about? Who was there? How did it work?
Well, the core of it, in terms of money, was Richard Mellon Scaife, who is a Pittsburgh billionaire and really a founding father of the modern conservative movement, even though he's certainly not a household name. And he has poured hundreds of millions of dollars since the early 1970s into building these various conservative institutions, publications, legal groups, media watchdog groups, etc. When Bill Clinton came into office, Scaife put more than $2 million into something called the Arkansas Project, which was run out of the American Spectator. And that was explicitly an anti-Clinton dirty tricks operation. Scaife was a conspiratorialist. He believed the Clintons were the head of a criminal syndicate. He believed that they had a hand in the murder of Vincent Foster. And these things may sound eccentric to you, but I think as you see in the book, because Scaife was who he was and because he had enormous influence on all these conservative institutions, he was able to enforce that view that he had on the Clintons on many of the conservatives. And so I think that's really the germ of it.
And it went from there out to media people, out to publishers in the American Spectator's case, out to a very few politicians, but that was the broadcasting center.
Yeah, and there was I think people can see that there's an amazing echo chamber on the right. Something would be published in the American Spectator. To use my own example, I first became known when Rush Limbaugh read my Anita Hill article verbatim for a few days on the air. And that has enormous impact when it gets that kind of circulation. So these things would start either at the American Spectator or Richard Meldenscave owns a newspaper in Pittsburgh that's a fairly small and relatively obscure newspaper. But then some of his foundations would take out ads in the Washington newspapers, reprinting really outlandish stories about the circumstances of Vincent Foster's death. And then that would get onto talk radio. There was a writer based in Washington for a newspaper in London named Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Often some of the, again, very outlandish and totally uncorroborated things about Clinton and being involved in drug running, for example, from Mena Airport in Arkansas, would first be floated in the London newspaper, the Sunday Telegraph, and then they'd make their way back here. They'd get into Rupert Murdoch's New York Post.
And as you know, David Brock, these things then filtered right down into American society, the American polity. I remember being quoted these things chapter and verse by people who fervently believed them in every detail. It created the carpet, the climate for the whole country in opposition to Bill Clinton.
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously, that the definition of a smear or of character assassination is exactly what we're talking about, that the things were said. Those who were predisposed, for whatever reason, to oppose the Clintons, whether it was political or whether they, had some personal, animus toward the Clintons, took all this up as fact, or they didn't even care whether it was fact, because when you're dealing at that level with that kind of political symbolism and that kind of raw anger, I don't know if the facts really matter, but they certainly took it because they were predisposed to believe it and broadcast it all over the place, and it was very difficult. I mean, I talk about a few cases in the book where things that are said about the Clintons are later disproven and conclusively debunked, but that never got any attention. Mm. That was buried.
We're talking with David Brock about his new memoir, Blinded by the Right. We're going to turn to the phones. Is this the tale of the big lie tactic working in the United States? And
yeah.
When David Brock says, I guess, David Brock, the question that I have listening to you is when you concede how much lying went on, how much lying you did in the 1990s, there's even a question of what we should make of you tonight. But I want to turn it over to the phones. Lee is on the line. Welcome, Lee. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. How are you doing?
Just fine, Lee.
Thanks. I just want to preface my questions by saying I consider myself a political moderate in the sense that I'm liberal on some things and conservative on others.
You're welcome here.
Thanks. And I'm saying this only because I don't want to be taken as a Clinton apologist, but I have to say that throughout the 90s, and I voted for Clinton, I was shocked by the way in which Tom DeLay and, say, Dick Armey conducted themselves. I thought a lot of the times it would detract from any argument they thought they were making. And I guess my question is twofold. One concerns a recent book published by a CBS insider that alleges that there's a liberal bias in the mainstream media, and I was curious what you thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my second question is, of course, NPR is one of them, but do you know any other media outlets that you consider to be fairly unbiased and can give you sort of a straightforward assessment of a candidate without having this slant that seems to tar, for the majority, Democratic politicians?
David Brock.
Unfortunately, I have not read the Goldberg book Bias, but I really can't comment on it directly or what kind of evidence is in there to prove the point. But I certainly didn't see. I mean, I have been in Washington for 15, 16 years. I've been in the conservative movement and I've been out of it. And I certainly didn't see any evidence in the things that I knew about and that I was writing about that would show a liberal bias in the media. In fact, quite the contrary, at least in the 1990s. I think I show in this book that what began as an effort on the right ended up being a subtle manipulation of the mainstream press on the issues of the Clintons, and ultimately it was not very difficult to get the mainstream press into a position where they had a vested interest in a kind of caricature of the Clintons.
Lee, thanks for your call. David Brock, speak to the core motivation of the people churning out this anger. What was it that they were so angry about, or are so angry about, and why?
Well, I think that the anger in the conservative grassroots, it really touches on a lot of different cultural issues. And I think that the Clintons were generationally, they were the first baby boomers to come into the White House. They were the first couple where the wife had a career of her own and was a feminist. And so I think they represented to the right wing out in the country a lot of the cultural and social changes that had happened since the 1960s that they really hated. And so I think that was fueling a good deal of it.
Jack, you've read right through this book. You know, you've, of course, seen where Robert Bork is saying that the STAR effort would be an enormous emetic for the country, culturally, politically, morally, to have an impeachment. I guess that was actually John Newhouse, the editor of the magazine First Things. But this notion that we needed a kind of a purging of everything Bill Clinton represented.
Yeah, I just don't know where this came from. And of course, the irony was Bill Clinton was a successful president by the usual measures, and he was a successful conservative Democratic president. He scooped the right wing on issue after issue, balanced the budget, welfare reform, other things. And he governed with a coalition often of triangulated, left his liberals out and relied on conservative or at least Republican votes for his measures. And yet, because of what he represented, he became the target of this kind of vituperation. And I think it's left a residue. I think that there's a harshness in language that's still being used by Clinton haters, and now they're using it in different directions, often against people who are in favor of peace, for example. And there was a kind of derangement that went on around Bill Clinton, and as someone who didn't feel even a sliver of it, I found it. I found it puzzling. I think we've got a good. We've got a good handle on it in what David Brock has said.
John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you, gentlemen?
We're well, John. Thanks.
I am, Mr. Brock. I think that you need to. You don't seem to be sorry for what you've done here.
Mm-hmm. I am very sorry for what I've done, and I don't know what else to say beyond I would hope that the sincerity of the apology and the regret that I feel does come through in the story that I tell in the book. It's been difficult to come to grips with this. I first went public with the apology to President Clinton about the Paul Jones case and the Troopergate case in March of 98 while impeachment was in the air. And I certainly saw him being hauled into that Paul Jones deposition and thought back to the role I had played in that and felt terrible and wrote that article at a time where it would have some political relevance to the impeachment, because I really felt that impeachment was very wrong.
But David Brock, to John's point, and we know you apologized to Anita Hill also, but when this kind of damage is done, and it's really damage in a way to the fabric of an entire nation, where do you turn for absolution, or is absolution possible? How do you, in a way, we're glad for all the facts in this book and to read and hear them, but how do you even have the nerve to stand up and write that?
Write
that's the question. Yeah.
Well, I think that, redemption is something for, a higher authority to consider, and it's not something that I can get through the writing of this book. I don't think it's possible to take things back that have been said and written. But I thought the test here was privately with my own conscience, I could have worked through this and didn't have to write this. This is a voluntary act. Nobody caught me in these things. So I think that the issue is what the test for this book was, is this something that should be documented for history? And I think that it's very difficult for people to understand what happened during the Clinton presidency, if they don't see the relentlessness of the opposition in the kind of detail that only somebody who was in it could bring.
John, I want to put it back to our caller. John, does that tone satisfy you?
Well, my tone came as a personal attack on the author. But the problem is that it's just like anything else. When a newspaper or any other media outlet makes a mistake, no one reads the recant, and as much as they read the original headline. And the problem is one of your commentators there talked about how, well, you had your first baby boomers and your first feminists. Well, I think that the kind of misinformation that Mr. Brock put out there, to consider that Hillary Clinton was a feminist, for example, and versus 96, the potential first lady was Bob Dole's wife, Liddy Dole, who, you know, in the traditional American way of thinking back in a different time of life, Liddy Dole took the feminist attempt, i.e. not getting married, not having children, being a career woman, and Mrs. Clinton, you know, turned down a chance to be in a major Washington law firm to go with her then boyfriend.
Yeah, John, it's a lot of history, and we thank you for your call, but we're trying to get to the heart of what David Brock is writing about here tonight, trying to make sense of the story of the 90s, of the story, in a way, of David Brock. David Brock, you write about how your own struggle with your sexuality also played into this somehow. Talk to us about that, about sex in the 90s, about sexuality, about your coming out with your own homosexuality. How did all that play into what went on?
I played into it significantly, and I think when you say, you know, what are all these people angry about, I obviously can't speak for all these people. It's a case-by-case basis, but I do think that, as I said earlier, there's an emotional component to this kind of angry politics, and in my case, some of it touched on the fact that I went to college in Berkeley. I was openly gay in the early 1980s and comfortable with that. When I came to Washington and got a job at the Washington Times, I gradually went back into the closet. And by the time I was at the Heritage Foundation in 1990, I was completely in the closet. And I think that there was some misdirected emotion that you can see in the anger of some of the writing during that period that has to do with the fact that I am leading a double life. I was able to rationalize this at first because there were so many other gay conservatives in the closet when I came here to Washington that it seemed to almost legitimate doing that. At a certain point, though, by 1992, when the party was explicitly gay bashing, there was no more denying to myself what I was involved in. And yet I was climbing up the conservative ladder, and I just went into denial about what kind of politics this movement really, really represented until I myself was subject to the kind of anti-gay bigotry. And then I learned a very bitter lesson that
when it hit you, it began to turn around. David Brock, we've got to take a short break. What was it that David Brock's right wing wanted to crush in the 1990s? David Brock helped crush Anita Hill and lay low Bill Clinton. Do you believe him now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with David Brock, author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. And Rick is calling from Geneva, Ohio. Welcome, Rick. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm talking to Dave. Is that right? I can ask.
David Brock can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. Dave, since you're no longer, and I take it what I've been listening to, since you're no longer a conservative, does that mean that you're the Bill Hillary type, the total opposite in? Or is it just that you're, what, like the middle of the road or what, Dave?
It's a good question to clarify. David Brock, you're very clear in your book that you've gone to the other side. How would you describe your politics today?
Well, I think they're pretty much in line with the Democratic Party. I registered as an independent in 2000, but I did vote for Al Gore because there are a cluster of issues, pro-choice, gay rights, the environment, civil rights. There are a cluster of issues that I felt that Gore was just stronger on. And this isn't flip-flopping on my part. I always had basically liberal social values. And I got swept up in a movement that was quite the opposite. And basically, I sold myself out and started to live a political lie.
David Bruck, I want to hear what Rick has to say about that. Rick, what do you think?
So,
David Bruck has gone to the other side.
It sounds like then he's saying he was kind of a phony. He wasn't really a conservative because he said, if I misunderstood what he said, well, I really didn't. I had these other views before I became a conservative.
But he's so making no bones about being a phony.
Sounds like he was kind of being a phony.
But if we take – and Rick, thank you for your call. David Bruck, Rick's kind of suggesting that because you were a phony, you were out of line with true conservatives.
Well, I don't think so. In fact, from my experience, and I spent a dozen years at the highest levels of the conservative movement in Washington, most of the people around me had no deep philosophical commitment to conservatism either. And one of the things that I think would be interesting for, you know, middle of the road or Republican oriented readers of this book would be to see what their leadership is really all about. This was a collection of hypocrites and confidence men and people who were taking these positions for all sorts of reasons other than true belief.
David Bruck, we're trying hard to gauge exactly how to read you now. Howard is on the line. Welcome, Howard. You're on the air.
Hi. A quick question for your guest, or two quick related questions. Number one, I'm sure we have not seen the end of this kind of stuff, so can you give us any nearly invariant or common characteristics of this kind of personally directed smear effort?
So we can see it in the future. Howard, I'm sorry we've only got time for one, but it's a good one. David Bruck, how can we spot this kind of thing if and when it happens again, or is it happening now?
Well, I think I have already spotted it in, for example, the attempt now to demonize Tom Daschle by the Republicans and the ads that were run comparing Tom Daschle to Saddam Hussein. That is right out of the Gingrich playbook of the 1990s. So the politics of destroying people's character, I think, is still with us. It's not not as apparent right now. It's receded, in my opinion, because the Republicans are in power and the conservative movement is happy now. And so the attack machine is not really working full time because the conservative movement is happier with this president than they've been at any time since the Reagan years. But if that dynamic should change, if the Democrats should pose a serious threat in terms of control of the Congress, if the Democrats come up with a very credible opposition to Bush in 2004. These tactics are not something momentary. I think they're deeply ingrained in the Republican political apparatus here.
We're almost out of time. Jack, I want to just come to you, but David Bruck, we got to say goodbye to you, and we're not sure quite how to send you off except to say go and be honest.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That's what I'm doing now.
David Bruck is author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Jack, we're wide open to honest conservatives and liberals and everything in between.
Absolutely.
On this show, but liars make my skin crawl.
Yeah, and the coin was lying. You know, journalism and corrupting our profession, no wonder the public has such a low opinion of it. It's really something. And, you know, for David Bruck, vice was not its own reward. Big money, $1 million advance for the Hillary book, $500,000 raise from the American Spectator, the townhouse in Georgetown that Anita Hill built. He made a lot of money on his friends then, and now he's probably making some money turning them in.
That's what you call a deal with the devil, Jack.
Well, he's familiar with those. That's his specialty.
Wow. More than we want to think about there tonight. But, Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
To read an excerpt of David Bruck's book, Blinded by the Right, go to our website at onpointradio.org. Tonight, we continue our series looking at the nominees in some of the Academy Awards' biggest categories for 2001. Tonight, 3 days before Hollywood's big night. One of the biggest prizes of the night, the Oscars for Best Director, is probably least well understood. The director is the boss, the visionary, the man or woman who calls the shot from the first frame to the final credits. Tonight, we'll look at this year's nominees for Best Director. We're joined by our movie maven, Garen Daly. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
Garen, what's the Academy look for in choosing the Best Directed Film of the Year? Is this the most political category, or are they really taking apart the craft of movie making here?
You know, they're trying to find something that is a little different, a little better than they have seen in other films.
Who's up for Best Director this year?
We've got Ridley Scott in Black Hawk Down. We've got Ron Howard in A Beautiful Mind. We have David Lynch in Mulholland Drive, Peter Jackson in Lord of the Rings, and Robert Altman, the 76-year-old Robert Altman in Gosford Park.
Ron Howard, he's made a lot of films, never been nominated for Best Director, or has he?
No, I don't believe he has been nominated for Best Director. And interestingly enough, I read an article, or actually I saw an interview with him. In it, he said, I don't think I could have made A Beautiful Mind without making Apollo 13, the film about the ill-fated journey to the moon. In that film, he found that you could make science sexy and make it palatable. And that's what he's done. He's taken a disease, schizophrenia, and mathematics, put them together and brought together all the different parts and made it really good. And one of the things that I really loved about the direction, it was seamless. You didn't know what was real and what wasn't
real.
Sure
didn't. Took a long time to figure that out.
And there's a couple little scenes like when he was, John Nash was playing with a piece of glass and the light was coming out. Mm-hmm. And he made this little prism and it showed all these wonderful little forms and geometric figures. Perfectly done, nicely constructed, and you're going, wow, what a beautiful little scene.
Who thought of that? Who made that happen?
Who made that happen? But it was Ron Howard who actually okayed that to happen.
You all know it's real. This is real. Maybe the part that knows the waking from the dream. Maybe it isn't here. Maybe it's here. I need to believe that something extraordinary is possible.
Jennifer Connelly in A Beautiful Mind and Ron Howard may be reaching some kind of new maturity in his directing of this film.
Oh, I believe so. I believe so. And what you don't see in this, because we just heard that, is Jennifer Connelly is taking her hand and putting her on his heart and his face and John Nash's heart and his face. And you can really feel that this is a very subtle scene and a wonderful scene, and Ron Howard made that happen.
Ridley Scott, Black Hawk Down, entirely different setting here.
You know,
the guns are blazing.
I find it so amazing that Ridley Scott made this film. This is the guy last year made Gladiator, and he wasn't up for Best Director. His film did win, though. And this year, he's up for Best Director, but his film is not in the Best Film. He's up for Best Director, but his film is not in the Best category. He's also the guy that made Alien and Blade Runner, very stylized things. Black Hawk Down is a nonstop, pedal-to-the-metal action-adventure film that just goes and goes and goes and keeps you glued to the seat.
It's 3 miles to the target area. We're never off the main road. At the K4 traffic circle, we turn north and east on National, and we wait until extraction of prisoners is complete here. Then we roll up in force on Hallwater. We load the prisoners and then the assault blocking forces and bring them back. Home in an hour. Okay? Now, there will be some shooting. The car market is the Wild West. But be careful what you shoot at because people do live there.
Ridley Scott's Black Hawk Down, I've heard him talk about making this film. The logistics sounded like he had to be pretty much a field marshal, a real general, to get this done.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. And as a result, I think he sacrificed character development and plot development for that action. You are stuck in that seat. You can't get out of it. But, you know, I think when you leave the theater, you're drained.
He did take the world into Somalia and Mogadishu. Robert Altman, Gosford Park. Robert Altman has such a great oeuvre. He's directed all over the place and so subtly and wonderfully for so many years.
And you see exactly, you know, the difference between Robert Altman and Ridley Scott is Robert Altman, you can know what a Robert Altman film is. It has lots of characters. You have overlapping dialogue. You have people who are walking in and out, plots, subplots going on. This is a perfect vehicle for him. It's almost the end of his career. It's a nice film for him to be involved in. He's doing a satire on Hollywood, English, upstairs, downstairs. It's a really wonderful little film that could not have been made in Hollywood.
I was looking for my maid.
She's just going downstairs. Can I help?
She was going to fetch me some chocolate, but now I wonder whether I wouldn't prefer milk.
Would that be hot milk? Or cold?
You decide.
I couldn't say, my lady.
Pop then, and want something to make it sweet. You have your hands in your pocket. Otherwise, I'll never sleep.
Why do you have trouble sleeping, m'lady?
I have a feeling I might have trouble tonight. I'll be wide awake at 1 a.m., bored to sobs.
Then we must try and think of something to amuse you.
Robert Altman's Gosford Park, he goes all the way back with so many films to Nashville, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. New tricks from the old director this time?
Not a lot of new tricks. I mean, he's a craftsman, and he's done a very craftsman-like job with this film. Again, it couldn't have been made in Hollywood. He's an unbankable director. Most of his films have not made money. This is the first one that's really broken through.
And does he still have the star power to draw the votes?
I don't think so. I think this is almost too smart for Hollywood, and I think Robert Altman is too much of a maverick, even though a lot of actors really love him.
Too smart for Hollywood. We'll fix that. Let's turn to Lord of the Rings and Peter Jackson.
Boy, is this a wonderful film or what? Let's give credit to Peter Jackson. Who would have thought that the guy who made one film for $30 million in his next film is $300 million budget, is going to make one of the greatest trilogies ever and do such a wonderful job? He took everyone down to New Zealand. They worked for 17 months. You can feel that this cast likes each other. That's a credit to Peter Jackson. And also, the fact is that he has seamlessly made all the special effects, all the computer-generated graphics blend so nicely into this film.
Let's listen to Lord of the Rings.
You draw far too much attention to yourself, Mr. Underhill. A little more caution from you. That is no trinket you carry.
I carry nothing.
Indeed. I can avoid being seen if I wish, but to disappear entirely, that is a rare gift.
Who are you?
Are you frightened?
Yes.
Not nearly frightened enough. I know what hunts you.
Lord of the Rings, directed by Peter Jackson. Can you win Best Director for Fairy Tales and Wizard Stories, Garendale?
You certainly can, and a lot of people are putting their money on Lord of the Rings. It's on the cusp of a lot of surveys out there that it is going to win this year.
Last nominee, David Lynch, works in a realm of fantasy very different from the Tolkien fantasy world.
You know, I like David Lynch, and I have to say that I'm actually surprised that this film is on the list. This was originally based on a TV show that got canceled. He got some money from France and tacked on an ending to it, and then all of a sudden it went to Cannes, and people started talking about how great it was. I have to say, Blue Velvet was good. The Straight Story was an excellent film by David Lynch, but I think it's pretentious as all heck.
This one's beyond your taste. Let's listen to a little bit of David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
There must be a police report we could call. No, we could call anonymously from a payphone just to see if there was an accident. Come on, it'll be just like in the movies. We'll pretend to be someone else. I want to walk around anyway. I'm in Hollywood, and I haven't even seen any of it.
But nobody gives you that sort of surreal, illuminating creeps like David Lynch.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. With this particular scene, they're pretending to be Nancy Drew, and that's kind of fun in Hollywood. That, I actually enjoyed that segment of the film much better than the other segments.
So from schizophrenia to David Lynch's surrealism and everything in between, who's your pick, Garendale, for Best Director?
Well, you know, the Directors Guild winner has won 49 of the last 54 years, and I'm not one to buck one of those trends, so Ron Howard is going to win with Beautiful Mind.
There you go. We're chalking up another potential win for Beautiful Mind. Could be a big year for them. Garen, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is a movie reviewer and critic, the owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. You can read more of Garen Daly's Oscar previews and predictions at our website. Just go to onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Karen Pelland and Laura Tenguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.